He is the OG.
Work if I put it in my pocket.
No, it's better. It picks up everything.
He's Howie Hawkins, from New York State, Syracuse. He was the gubernatorial candidate for the Green Party in 2014, where he won what percent?
5%.
5% of the vote. And we're going to be talking today about how to build the Green Party into a mass membership organization. And that's what it's about. So, get started, Howie.
Yeah, so Bruce is the technician. He put this on a PowerPoint. We have an outline that at some point we'll make available as soon as we get a few corrections.
Yeah, that's another thing. Pass this around. And what we will do is anybody who gives me a name and an email address, we will send you a copy of the outline and some other related materials. So if you want to pass that around, please print the name so it can, please print the name and print the email so it can be read. Thank you.
So that's the first lesson. We're taking names. You can't just do social media and just throw it out there. You've got to find out who your supporters are, who you can recruit to the party. You've got to know your base in your neighborhood, in your city, in your union, you know, wherever you're organizing. So Bruce just demonstrated one of the first things we got to do. But we want to talk about the Green Party, and we've got a problem. We used to be a party of local chapters. People pay dues. We were represented nationally, proportioned to the membership. And in the 90s, state parties started getting ballot lines, and they said, hey, in California, we got 100,000 registered members and only 500 paid members. We should have more power in the national party. And it became this big struggle over whether we're going to represent actual living, breathing people who supported the party or virtually represent people who told the state they're in the party, no matter what their policy. And I'm not going to go into the history of how that fight went on throughout the 90s, but in the end, we ended up with the same model as the Democrats and Republicans. Enrollment parties where power structure is dictated by state law. And the problem is we lost our funding base and we lost our grassroots organized base. So we defunded and disorganized ourselves. And Bruce and I believe the solution is that we need to go back to that other model. And we're going to go over the history of parties, how they developed, how this mass membership party is an invention of the left. It was how they competed with the top-down parties that were the first parties as parliamentary systems or legislative systems developed, and talk about the things this solution can do, the dues financing, and the idea that the little people won't make little contributions and fund a mass movement. The Bernie Sanders campaign disproved that. 2.5 million contributors. When they raise 150 million or more?
200 million.
Okay, so an idea that we can't fund it with little people, I think, has been disproven. We believe the solution enables mass participation. We talk about grassroots democracy, but if you can't go to your local Green Party meeting and talk about what's an issue we got to address, how we organize a campaign, what our position should be on something, who our leaders should be, even if our leaders are not representing us, how we replace them. You don't go to your local Democratic committee to decide how we're going to fight for $15 minimum wage in the city or how we're going to fight TPP. You go to the old party committees basically to get networking. You want a job with the city public department of public works. You want a contract from the mayor. You know, you start paying your dues in the party committees, which just mobilize people. They are not what we think of when we have a green open meeting where, you know, we talk about issues and how we're going to organize. So if we're going to have a mass party, we've got to have a way for the masses to get engaged. We think one of the missions of a party should be to unite us, the people, the working people. We're divided by race, obviously. We have increasing geographic race and class segregation in this country over the last four decades. And within the working class, we're divided between union, non-union. The non-union kind of resent the union benefits that the union people got. Big and small business, different kind of work. You work alongside your boss in a small business, you got a different mentality than if you're working for a big corporation and a management hierarchy. You've got public workers and private workers. Public workers, generally, although these were, they're losing this, have defined benefit contributions. Private workers tend to have been moved over to the defined contribution, 401k program. So private workers resent the public workers. So we got those divisions. Then we got all these people in the prison system, in the welfare system, who are working class. And you got some working class people that are sitting on the other side of the bar watching them, or the other side of the desk, you know, dealing with their benefits. And so we need a place where people can come around in the city across these divisions and find a common interest. And this is not going to happen by, you know, social media saying let's treat each other with respect or deal with our white supremacy or whatever. We got to get down face to face and hammer out, you know, and find out what a common interest are. That's something that a party needs to do. And Bruce, you go.
I'm going to say we need to stick to the script. Because what you're saying is in there.
Well, I'll give them the summary first.
Okay. All right.
And it's going, we're talking about our party should be involved in building social movements, not just joining them. And Bruce is going to talk more about that later. Because the nonprofit industrial complexes with the big money behind it is kind of dictating our agenda. And finally, it should be a place where we do political education. So I should be looking up here, right? Instead of my own. Okay, so
it's close.
Okay, well, I think I covered this slide.
So. Yeah, you did. The Green Party is like, are we a fit home for the thousands of folks who are looking for a political home right now? Anybody thinks we are?
I
would say ideologically, but if in your state 200 people walked in the door tomorrow, or 300 walked in the door tomorrow, could you handle that administratively or any other way? You couldn't do it. And who thinks there aren't 300 people in California or Illinois or Pennsylvania or Georgia? There are. I guarantee you there are. So we can't handle it. Anyway, why can't we handle it? Because we're too weak to compete, we're underfunded and understaffed, we're unable to communicate, like Howard just said, and why? We're too weak to compete because we're imitating the organizing model of Republicans and Democrats. Democrats and Republicans both use 1% of money and corporate media to communicate with their followings and to lead a mass following. And their candidates and their campaigns are completely independent of and completely not responsible to their local party organizations or their voters. Look at Donald Trump. How did he get the nomination?
Money.
He bypassed, he bypassed all the local Republican organizations, all right, and he used his reality star cachet and lots of free media that they gave him for no good reason, and he won the primaries. Bernie demonstrated his independence from his base too by uncritically embracing Hillary despite the, you know, what a lot of his followers wanted. There you go. The Green Party has been following their model, only without the money and without the media. How's that work?
Not very well.
I was quiet, but he wrote most of this shit, okay? Like I said, I just put it in the PowerPoint. Why is the Green Party in the state? Again, because we're imitating their model, and we just covered that. Also, we said we're imitating their model? The Jill Stein campaign. I've been working for the Jill Stein campaign. The Jill Stein campaign has 5 or 6 times the number of employees and many times the budget of the National Green Party. Mm-hmm. There you go.
And that's true with the Democratic and Republican parties. They are not only capitalist ideologically, they're capitalist as an institution, because the real power structure in the Democratic Party are not the formal committees. Like I said, that's where you go to network, you know, to get a job or a contract. The real power structure are the campaign organizations. Each candidate is an entrepreneur. They hire some people they form a little company, and then they seek the investors. And the big money, the fat cats invest in these different campaigns and largely determine who comes out on top. And so that's the real dynamic there. Now, in the Greens, it's a little different in that we don't accept the corporate money, but we have people who, you know, basically professional class people who got more time and discretion over their time and more money, and they tend to dominate in our politics in the informal structure we've got. And one of the things we're talking about, this mass membership structure, is not only the grassroots members supporting it financially, but having a way to hold the whole organization accountable to them at the base. So that's where the Greens are a little bit different than the Democrats and Republicans, but the problem is our formal structures aren't really providing the leadership and the accountability. It's the initiative of candidates. And when I ran for governor, I raised $200,000. The state budget of our party is around $20,000. So there you go. In the Greens' national budget, after we pay $100,000 for fundraising, we have about $200,000 to spend. You know, that's the size of a basically underfunded nonprofit in the hood. You know, it's not, and we're trying to be a national party. So that's why we're saying we need to look to a different model.
So where's the money going to come from? Where? Dues. Come on. What do people pay in church?
Tithes.
Well, they call it tithes, but it's still dues, isn't it? What's the difference? Dues give us the financial resources we need. The Sanders campaign is only the most recent example that the money is out there. It's also proved by the existence of tens of thousands of churches, small and large, that run off the tithes of willing believers who are often the poor.
Oh, yeah.
So if people are willing, if they buy what you're doing, they'll contribute. Dues give us the financial resources we need. We already said that.
Yeah, this is the part I was coming.
Clearly, way ahead of us. The other thing is that locals, underneath the national and underneath the state, I mean, you can organize by counties, but, you know, whatever you want to call it, but Georgia, where I live, has, 112 counties, is that right?
159
counties. A couple of counties have a population of 2,000.
Right.
The county I live in has a population of 700,000.
Right.
And there's one county floating with 1 million, and,
wow,
and three more counties with 800,000. So, you know, so if you're organizing by counties, then are you going to give the 2,000 people the same voice as the 1 million people? I don't know if you want to do that.
How many
locals do enable mass participation? Locals are where your grassroots people can be active in the party. And again, if the party's not active, who's going to pay dues? And questions, we'll have a good period for questions at the end. Locals give us the grassroots organization for grassroots democracy. They're training grounds. Locals make possible, active locals make possible the accountability of party officials on every level and accountability of campaigns and candidates, which are not accountable often. Party locals are where we can begin to unify the working class by building relationships and solidarity. Solidarity across lines of race, geography, solidarity across occupational divisions. How is way ahead of us? I told you he wrote this stuff so we could spill it out. Solidarity of big business employees versus small business employees, private sector versus public sector. I mean, what's the difference between a private sector worker and a public sector worker? Just who signs the paycheck. That's it. The only way they want you to think different is so they can get you one at a time. And of course, the difference, solidarity between and among folks who work in the welfare and prison systems and folks who are in the welfare and prison systems. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what state you're from, but in Georgia, a prison guard is a sub-minimum wage job. That's how all the cell phones get in there. Okay, they gotta make some side money some kind of way, you know? Party locals are where we can build social movements, not controlled by the whims of corporate funders. We'll talk a little bit more about that later on. And where did the nonprofit thing come from? okay? Some of you have read history from back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Did they have nonprofit organizations and single-issue organizations back then? Heavens no. That is, those things are an invention of the funders from the late 50s, early 60s, post-civil rights era, 60s, 70s. That's where it came from. Hey, bro, can you do us a favor and get three or four more chairs from somewhere? We got space back there for them. Please, if you can get just three or four more. Okay, yeah, before the 1960s and the rise of the nonprofit industrial complex, social movements were not built by single-issue organizations competing for grants. They were built by self-funding, dues-paying parties, by labor unions, and by farmers' alliances. In the latter half of the 19th century, the labor unions and farmers' alliances organized parties. In the first half of the 20th century, left parties organized unions, consumer rights, peace and civil rights campaigns. Bang. Party locals are where we can conduct political education. We want to change the world, okay? Would you trust a doctor who hadn't studied the human body?
Hell no.
Okay, would you trust a dentist who hadn't studied mouths and teeth? Why should we trust a party whose members don't study how parties are put together and how societies are put together? Who don't talk about it? Do Democrats do political education?
No.
Yeah, it's called the TV. It's called CNN and MSNBC. Republicans do it on Fox. Some of it happens in your school, too.
Yeah.
Political education and study groups, forums about social problems, the systems and the power structure. I live in Atlanta. Atlanta's a fairly big city. Metro was like 5 million people. When interesting folks like Howie or somebody come through town, is there a place where we can say, oh, who's going to be in town this 2 weeks? Howie's going to be in town, and after that, 2 weeks later, Cornel West is going to be here. Where is the place where we can take them to have them speak and draw an audience, the people they're used to coming to? You know where? Nowhere. It doesn't exist. But if we had a dues-paying party, self-financing party, we'd have a stable place to meet. We'd have a hall we could call on where we wouldn't have to labor under the stuff that you do when you get somebody's church and they say, well, you know what, you can use the hall here, but you can't talk about politics, you can't talk about running for office.
Yeah, my church.
And well, some churches you can, but many you can't. Okay, and some other places you can, many, and you can't and you can't collect any money. But you gotta pay us for the hall, but you can't collect any money.
Yeah.
Political education, we're talking about political education about what our policy platform, socialism, ought to be. Political education about how to organize and maintain party bodies. We'll talk more about that, issue campaigns, electoral campaigns, and more. Whoa, did I skip something? Yes, I did. There. Hey, a brief history of political, I'm gonna turn this over to Howie. Howie's got big shovels, and he's got all this stuff up here, so deal.
Well, there's a lot of information in the outline, and I'm not gonna go over it in detail, but historically, parties came from the top down. We had representative bodies back when even the Roman Senate, you know, and they had factions. They had the patricians representing the landed elite, the nobles, and the plebeians representing basically the merchants and middle class. And then they kind of disappeared till we started getting representative assemblies starting in England, the English Civil War, English Revolution. Different classes started fighting for who would have the power. So the parliamentarians, or the roundheads, opposed the royalists or the cavaliers in England in the Civil War, and by the time the revolution in 1688 came out, the pro-parliament Whigs were fighting the pro-monarchist Tories. And that was the beginning of parties. And in the United States, it came from the legislative caucuses, the Hamiltonians and the Jeffersonians. And the Hamiltonians were tended to be pro-England, pro-monarchy, the Jeffersonians, pro-revolutionary France, pro-democracy, except when the Haitian Revolution happened, they weren't for that, you know, because a lot of them were planters and slave owners. So a lot of contradictions there, but basically that was the first party system. It came from the top down. Nominees were appointed by these legislative caucuses, but as Republican ideals spread amongst the people, they were demanding we shouldn't have a property qualification on the vote. We should all vote. And so in the Jacksonian era, which was the second party system, they got rid of the property qualifications. And then an American invention was a convention. What we're doing today was invented by a third party, which was the, I think it was the anti-Mason party up in New York in 1830. And then the platform started coming in the same period. And it was third parties that kind of raised it at that period. And so the Hamiltonians disappeared, the Federalists who, you know, were kind of anti-democratic, and you had, you know, the Whigs and the Democrats, and that was the next party system. The next party system was growing out of the Liberty Party, abolition, which evolved into Free Soil Party, which was free labor, free men, free labor, free soil, and free speech. And that became the Free Soil Party and then the Republican Party. And so by the mid-50s, 58 election, the Republicans established them as the second party in Congress. And then Lincoln was actually a second party candidate, not a third party candidate, in a four-way race. And that led to the Democratic and Republican system, which has evolved with different dominant coalitions. But in that period, third parties were very important. Not just the Liberty, Free Soil, Republican effort, but after that, the Farmer Labor Populist Party. They defined, as did the abolitionist parties, the issues that were debated in their time and elected thousands of people from local, state to Congress, and senators, governors. They were called first the Greenback Labor Party, then the Anti-Monopoly Party, then the Union Labor Party, and finally the People's Party. And they fought for civil rights. They fought to reestablish Reconstruction. General Weaver, everybody knows he was the People's Party candidate in 1892 and got 6-7% of the vote, but he was the Greenback Labor Party in 1880, and he was running around the South under armed protection to make sure the Klan didn't break up meetings, but they insisted be open to everybody, black and white, and so they were fighting the imposition of what became Jim Crow. That was a 20-year fight in which third parties, in a contradictory way, but definitely were fighting the imposition of Jim Crow and the disenfranchisement of black people and also poor people in the South, because when they put a poll tax or a literacy test, it not only affected black folks, it affected poor white folks. But that was another party system. And then they evolved. The New Deal Coalition broke up, started in the 30s, broke up in the 80s. And then we have two very conservative parties since that time. And we call it neoliberalism or the imposition of austerity. But the point is, the party systems change. And today, you know, Lynn Ford at Black Agenda Report, a guy named Michael Lynn, is one of these think tanks. People are looking at what's going on now, where you have a rebellion from below of the voting base against the elites controlling both parties, which have imposed austerity on the working people and got us involved with a bunch of damn wars that people really don't want to be involved in. So the party system may be breaking up right now. You've got the corporate militarists, definitely got the Democratic Party with Clinton. You got the Sandinistas who really don't, there's a contradiction there. And we're the party where they ought to be. And we're getting some indication people are coming to us. So that's the Democratic coalition splitting between progressives and, you know, the corporate militarist elites. And then on the Republican side, there's three factions fighting for the Republican break. You've got the old Republican, the country club Republicans, the Wall Street Republicans, the corporate militarists, pretty much like Clinton. Some of them are supporting Clinton this time because they can't stand Trump. They're trying to hold on. And then you got the Trumpists. Now, Trumpism to me is whatever's good for Donald Trump. I mean, I don't think he stands for anything but himself. But the base has said, we don't want our Social Security. We don't want entitlement reform. We don't want our Social Security check. We earn those benefits. And we don't like these formulas. And we don't like what you Republican elites have been doing. We're downwardly mobile. This is, you know, why working class and middle class folks. Our life expectancy is going down. So we got issues. And so we're voting for this guy that seems to be thumbing his nose at the establishment. So that's the Trump faction, the populist faction. And then you've got two Republicans running on the Libertarian ticket, former Republican governors, who are trying to represent sort of the moderate Republican, socially liberal, an older type of Republicanism that's pretty much been pushed out of the party but still exists. So it's very interesting. What does that mean for us? like Bruce was saying earlier, we could be flooded. And are we organized enough? Do we have the resources to respond to these people who expect when they say, I want to help, for somebody to get back to them and help them help? And so that's why we need to think about how we're structured. So the other part of the history, you want to go into the different party structures, you know,
we're half, what do we got, 75 minutes?
Yeah, I'll just give it a summary.
Yeah,
we can so people get a sense of,
yeah, sure,
of what's, where we've gone. So the legislative caucus system was top down. I talked about that. So you came with the open convention system as a response. So these third parties and eventually the Democrats and Republicans, when it's time to, this is the 1830s, 40s, 50s, in the 19th century, when they want to have a national convention, and when a third party wants to start a third party, they say, everybody interested in this, come to the precinct caucus, and we're going to elect delegates to the county convention, and the county convention will elect delegates to the state convention, and the state to the national. More democratic than the top-down legislative caucus system, but the problem is, when the doors are open to whoever wants to show up, and there's no commitment to the party, and say, financially in terms of dues, or agreement with a set of political principles, you can get a situation where, and this happened in the 1890s with the People's Party, in 96 they ended up crossing doors from the Democrat. The populist delegates from areas where the Farmers Alliances were organized, they tended to be for, we're gonna run our own candidate. But in the areas where they were not well organized, you had opportunists from the major parties showing up. Republicans in the South, Democrats in the North, and they wanted to do fusion coalition with the populace in order to get elected. And that wreaked havoc in terms of the state People's Party, and before that, Greenback Labor and Union Labor.
Yeah, when you don't have a party, when you're relegated to having the nonprofits lead the movement, I was at a meeting in North Carolina. Where's Michael at? I was at a meeting in North Carolina where they were championing fusion. I mean, there was a room full of people, 75, 80 people. Joe was there. And they were saying, the way to go is, what's the word? Fusion is the way to go.
And so, yeah, and confusion led to confusion in the 19th century. And eventually, when they crossed the doors, William Jennings Bryan, that was the end of that whole series of farmer labor populist parties. And you see what the reason is that anybody could show up. And they came here with different agendas, so you couldn't really control what was going on. And I just want to read a quote from Lawrence Goodwin, who, you know, is one of the foremost historians of populism. And he said, in the populist moment, in democratic terms, the structural weakness of the People's Party evolved from the failure of its organizers in the founding convention in 1892 to understand that the third party, to be authentically democratic, had to be organized as a mass party with a mass membership. Instead, it was organized, like all large American parties before and after, as a representative party, with elite cadres of party regulars dominating the organizational machinery from precinct to national convention. The People's Party spoke, rather more tellingly than most American parties have ever done, in the name of the people. But in structural terms, the People's Party was not made up of the people. It was comprised of party elites. Its ultimate failure, therefore, was conceptual, a failure at the theoretical level of democratic analysis. There's a quote. So, you see what he's saying. They had these farmers' alliances. They had between the Colored Farmers' Alliance and Cooperative Union in the South, the White Farmers' Alliance in the South, the Northern Farmers' Alliance. They had 7.2 million dues-paying farmers, agriculture workers, and allied industrial workers, the remnants of the Knights of Labor, and so forth, paying dues. And instead of saying, instead of delegating from those local organizations to their conventions, they said, we're gonna open up a parallel structure. Anybody who wants to show up, show up. So these opportunistic Democrats and Republicans that eventually diluted the populist program and their political independence. Now, the other thing that was going on in this open convention system was party bosses, urban machines. And the reason we ended up going to primaries, the progressive movement said, we got these bosses. And so when they call the precinct caucus in the machine area, you know, you've got thugs sometimes saying, you're in because you're with us, you're not because you might not be. And basically the bosses control from the top down. And in the end, the smoke-filled rooms you know, decided who the nominees would be. So the progressive movement said, oh, we're going to do the primary system as a way of getting out of the smoke-filled rooms. But they were also aimed at the Socialist Party, who kept Democratic conventions. You had to be a member to go to their conventions, and they were taking over cities. So the progressives was, you know, in the popular rhetoric, it was going after these machine bosses, but it was also going after the Socialist Party. So from 1900 to 1920, primary spread across the states. So what have you got there? You know, it's not only more Democratic, but in fact, remember that party structure I talked about, the candidate organizations with the capitalist money invested in them? They pre-select who the people get to vote for when they get to the primary ballot. And in the meantime, the people are atomized, they're not organized, they're not discussing among themselves what our program is and who the candidate should be to represent us. They just show up at the primary, and they've been advertising that by the mass media. Today it's TV, back then it was newspapers. And so it was supposed to be more Democratic. In fact, it was just a more sophisticated way of having the open convention system with party bosses controlling. Now the Socialists at the time, they set up a membership organization. Your state party was recognized when you had an X number of locals. It's in the notes here somewhere.
There it is, yeah. The Socialist Party developed a different structure. Democratic membership convention.
And they drew two lessons from the People's Party. First, their party constitution said, we're not going to fuse with Democrats and Republicans, because that killed the populace. Now, they put it right in their constitution. Secondly, only members who pay dues can vote in party decisions. They decided living, breathing members who are committed to the party enough to give a small donation every year are the ones that are going to make the decisions, not whoever shows up. And one of the things, if you've been involved in movements, when things are exciting, all kinds of people flood up, and it's like, some people think, well, it hasn't worked because I haven't been here, but now I got all the solutions. You know? And then they create chaos and phone decisions, and then they flood out when the movement, you know, wanes, and the people that are committed there for the long haul are left with their decisions. So,
second, only members who pay dues, like you said, can vote on party conventions, because you don't want to be flooded by folks who are going to leave tomorrow and not have any stake.
So, right, here we go. These are their state party, they'd have at least 10 locals with 5 members, 200 members total. This is their 1917 constitution. And their per capita dues, the way they did it was the state party pays per capita for the members. So you sign a membership form, send it to the national office, and then the state party pays your per capita, kind of like the AFL-CIO for those of you in the labor movement. It was about $10 in today's dollars that the state party paid to the national for every movement. So we got some numbers, I think, if we put them in later, that would explain how much money that would raise for us. So the Socialists maintain the system alongside the primary system. The state election laws mainly are concerned with who gets to vote in the primary. So the Socialists, I wish I could flip it to the next page, but I'll read the quote. They said, in criticism of this primary system, they said in the Socialist Call in 1914, in their eagerness, their being the progressives, in their eagerness to get the reputation for being small D Democrats, these pseudo-Democrats who are running things now just want to break up political parties. In other words, atomize them, like I was talking about before. If they really wanted to have real democracy, they would pattern parties after our party. So this was a conscious debate on the left, whether primaries were actually more democratic or a diversion from membership conventions where the leadership of the party, the candidates, are actually answerable to their membership.
And so, it's a debate you hear nothing about anymore. I mean, before I started looking at this a few weeks ago and reading the stuff that Howie sent me, I never heard anybody question the primary election. Where did it come from? Everything comes from somewhere. These things come from somewhere. This is why we need locals, so that thousands, tens of thousands, millions of folks can be able to hear this history and appreciate it and make their judgments knowing it.
Let's give that example from New York, because I think, you know, the establishment at this time saw that too.
Socialists in 1920.
In 1910, there were 18 socialists elected to the New York State Assembly in New York State, and they were anti-war. So in 1920, there were only 5. You know, you had the Red Scare, the Palmer Raids, you know, Eugene Debs was running for president from jail, but they still elected 5. And the Democrats and Republicans said, we're not seating you because you're anti-war and disloyal, if not treasonous. So they called a special election, and their districts reelected the socialists. And then we get to 1920, and they get reelected again, and they are not seated. So the Judiciary Committee Assembly says, all right, we got to justify this. So they did a 4,428-page report on revolutionary and subversive movements abroad and at home. And I stumbled upon this in Google, and they got, you want to read about the Serbian socialist movement in 1920? It's there. Sri Lanka, you know, every Latin American country, Asia, and they got New York. And here's what they said about New York, which I think is very revealing. The expression Socialist Party of America is really a misnomer for a group operating under this name. It's not a party. And the Socialist Party is in reality a membership organization. A distinction must be drawn at this time between members of the Socialist Party of America and the enrolled socialists. A person enrolling in the Socialist Party under the Socialist Party emblem on registration day in the state does not thereby become a member of the Socialist Party of America.
In other words,
you get the point.
Yeah. In other words, the last thing the Socialist Party was outlawed because, in their terminology, it wasn't a party; it was an organization. They want you in parties, but they don't want you organized.
In other words, enrollment parties where you show up at primary and vote for the candidates they pre-selected for you.
Is to be disorganized,
right?
By definition. And more examples, early 20th century, we can skip some of that, but...
Yeah, the basic point here is there was a bunch of third parties, Wisconsin Progressive Party, Minnesota Labor Farm, Farmer Labor Party, North Dakota Nonpartisan League, and several local labor and farmer labor parties. Like there was a farm labor party in Berlin, New Hampshire, a paper mill town, and way up north by Canada, half of them spoke French. The farmer labor party ran that city in the 40s and 50s. So, but in the period before that, you know, here's what was going on. The progressives and farmer labor, I said, two governors, four senators, and 13 members of Congress. Unions are passing resolutions for a labor party. FDR polls, National Democratic Committee polls, and finds if, you know, Floyd Olson from Minnesota or Huey Long from Louisiana runs third party on a more radical program than the New Deal. And remember, the first New Deal was basically, it was fascist. You know, it was coordination between corporations and the government. It wasn't Social Security, National Labor Relations Board, WPA. That came in response to this. So Floyd Olson died of cancer.
And so FDR would have lost in a three-way race.
Right.
And maybe that's why Huey Long died suddenly.
He got assassinated. So the Democrats went all out to co-op. They used fusion in New York, American Labor Party. Socialist, the first principle of socialist politics was independence from the capitalist parties. But they said FDR worked with some garment labor union people and the Communist Party to set up the American Labor Party as a line where socialists could vote for FDR and then vote for the socialists further down. And it basically, over time, it went down the ballot, so pretty soon this became the second line for the Democrats. So what happened in 1936 under this populist front, the labor movement, the communists, who were pretty big at that time, 40,000 members, said we're going into the New Deal coalition. The rationale was unite with the liberal capitalists against the fascists.
Yeah, we're gonna move the Democratic Party to the left. It's original. Come on, these folks just thought of this.
Well, the thing about the party structures is third parties were influential from the 1840s to the 1930s. Since 1936, we've had very little impact on national policy. Because we've been really on the margin. The mainstream of left liberal politics, progressive politics is work inside the Democratic Party. When you hear the word progressive, that means the socialists are in there with the liberals following the liberals, backing the Democrats, as a lesser evil to the Republicans. So, that's why we need dues and hey, grassroots organizations.
If somebody isn't, I mean, I've heard, and some of you have heard arguments against a dues paying membership. Well, people aren't going to pay for a political party. You know what? Some people won't. And those are probably the people who you don't want in the room anyway.
Yep.
At least not making the decisions. Not today. When they're ready, they're ready, and they'll come and they'll pay dues and they'll help out. And when they're not ready, you don't need them in the room. They can watch. if somebody's not committed enough to contribute a modest amount to support the party, why do we want to give them power and decision-making power? And also, if you define your members as the people who pay dues, then there's actually a defined bunch of people for your officers to be responsible to. If you are in the Green Party right now, and you're in the Black Caucus, hey man, who are people in the Green Party and the Black Caucus responsible to exactly? Mm-hmm. You know, see? Or the Latinx Caucus. What defined body of people are they responsible to? What defined body of people are many of your national committee members responsible to? It was like whoever came in the room that day. Seriously. Without clear membership standards, party organizations are subject to the problem of people flooding in. You already said that. Like the Nader campaign, making decisions without the experience of committed party members, and then leaving. And this is how the Green Party structure was changed from the original mass membership structure of dues paid membership organizing the locals into the top-down mobilization model of the Democrats and Republicans. The Greens fought over that back in the late 90s. Mr. OG here, you can guess what side of it he was on. There was one side that wanted a Democratic party model and the other that wanted a dues paying membership model. And there was the Nader campaign, and Nader decided to go to the convention of the folks who wanted to be like Democrats. And what y'all do?
Yeah, the Association of State Green Parties, they wanted to, they said, we're going to be like the big boys, Democrats and Republicans now. Forget this locals and dues paying. Let the state parties take care of that.
Yeah, the Democrats, look, it works for them, it worked for us.
And then we had the other side say, we need to keep that structure and adapt it to being on a ballot. And Nader was bigger than both factions. You know, we're fighting like cats and dogs, and, you know, Nader's over here, and, you know, he basically told us they wanted to do this and we're crazy. So we went to the other convention, and we said, Nader's bigger than both of us, we gotta be where the Greens are. And so that's how it was resolved, you know, politically. Nader just, the irony was some of those people then turned on Nader after the backlash from 2000. In any case, it's not important how it happened, it did happen. And the question we have to ask now, nearly 20 years later, is are we better off with this structure? I would argue we are less well funded. You call the national and ask for help and they refer you to somebody who's on their contact list locally. We don't have national organizers. And most states that need the help don't have organizers. So we're not very responsive to people who want to get involved in the Green Party. And so we're less well organized. And then at the grassroots, we had about 300 locals in the mid-90s when this fight started happening. I don't know what we got now, but I don't think we got that many. Or if they are, they're not publicizing what they're doing very well.
They're hiding, they're secret, and they're underground.
Yeah, we have a lot of state parties that where all the activity is just at the state level. So, we're arguing for, we got to keep the Federation of State Parties like the Socialist Party had back in the 1900 to 1936 period. We've got to, have a national membership standard. I don't want to get ahead of the outline again, but.
Start here, the dues could be submitted to the national with a significant percentage related to organized state party operations, which could in turn rebate half of that to local parties. There's a number of ways we could do this. Or states could collect dues and provide people with a per capita, like you said organized labor does. Say 10 bucks a member, like the Socialist Party does, and then share the rest between the state level and local. And by the way, if you've got a stable thing of organized people who are submitting dues, there's people with real means who kick in more. You know that.
Wisconsin.
You know that.
Be dues based.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. And that's the state.
Well, we're about to be dues based in Georgia.
Yeah.
So let's see what's gonna happen. Let's see where it goes. Dues could be a sliding scale. We're talking about asking for 10 or 15 a month in Georgia. I mean, come on. $15 is what, like three lattes, right?
Yeah.
A month? Please, come on. And if you can't pay that, okay, well then you can pay $10. Please. You know, dues could be sliding scale. What kind of money could this raise? Assuming everybody's poor and pays $30 a year, 10,000 members would raise 300,000. That's almost three times what the GPUS had in 2016.
I had the number wrong earlier.
Okay, yeah. But you get the idea. 100,000 members under that would raise 3 million. I would make it $10 a month is 120 a year. So if you multiply this times 4, 100,000 members would give you $12 million.
This should be on the next slide.
Yeah, it should. It should. It should. A million members could raise a lot more. I don't know how many more. At this point, we're approaching the scale of the Knights of Labor. That's a blast from the past, ain't it? 1886. A blast from somebody's past. But $30 is low. Acorn was membership supported.
Yeah.
Okay, that's one of the reasons they had to disband it, to wreck it. The National Welfare Rights Organization.
And they being
was
the Democrats, the Republicans,
oh, yeah,
right. And the Democrats, Obama, my member of Congress.
Went along with it.
Yeah, and then they found out the accusations weren't true, but it was too late for Acorn.
Way too late. $30 is low. Anyway, this is all projections. But you get the idea. You can do your own arithmetic. Everybody graduated the fourth grade or fifth grade. Green Party locals. There's no necessary conflict between encouraging locals and state parties. If you're going to do this democratically, ultimately, your members of your locals will elect your state parties. You know, on a one-person, one-vote basis. The membership form, our membership form, this is a place where we ought to emulate the socialists. They made a lot of mistakes, but it should include a pledge that the member agrees to that by signing affirms their agreement with basic party principles. We don't have nothing like that now either, do we? At least not in Georgia where I'm at. And the current representation formulas for the National Committee and National Convention are kind of complicated.
Yep.
They're kind of complicated. Campaign strength, in-state voting strength, presidential voting strength, and the phase of the moon, and whether Libra is in retrograde or something.
The basic point is the people being represented, they don't even know who's representing them or that they're being represented. Right? The enrollees of a party where you keep enrolling in a state, unless they're insiders and knew about how to petition or how to get appointed depending on, you know, the structure of the state and the state election laws, have no idea who's representing them, how to hold them accountable.
Yeah, please sign the sign-in sheet. Those of you who have not seen the sign-in sheet, raise your hand so we can see who you are, and each other can see who you are. Okay, look at the person. Okay, make sure you get to sign the sign-in sheet. We need your name printed legibly and your email printed legibly, and we will send you the outline and a link to the video of this. All right?
So for a party that talks about grassroots democracy, our grassroots are detached from the leadership bodies. And, you know, they all be living, breathing Greens that meet. That's the grassroots base. And that should be where we elect our leadership, or choose our candidates, come up with our platform. So that's why we got to not rely on just what the state regulates. All they care about is who goes to vote in primaries. That's all state election law cares about. It's the main thing it cares about. So in closed primary states that keep party enrollments. In open primary states where you can choose which party you're going to vote in on election day, like Vermont, they don't even keep the enrollment. I think 23 states are like that.
Yep. We got to finish talking at half past so we can have adequate time for
okay. Okay, so the point being, you know, that's why Bernie Sanders, he can say he's a Democrat and he wants to run for president, but in Vermont they don't even know what he is because they don't keep a list. But that's all state election law cares about. And sometimes they set up party structures. But let me get to the legality question. You want to do that now?
Why not? Okay, well, I got to find it. Let's stick to the script because that way we will get it.
Okay.
We'll just rush through. We will get to it. Green Party locals, however you define them. The national should have standards for locals that locals have to meet. Locals must have regular meetings and activities. The locals have to be where the social movement takes place. The social movement is way too important to be left to the whims of the funders of nonprofits. Right now, in your state, if your Green Party is not leading the social movement in your neighborhood, and you'll wind up having to go to somebody else's meeting. The meeting is run by a nonprofit person. They'll look at you over there as the Green Party, and they'll, in their imagination, you are just another single issue organization whose issue is electing people. How messed up is that? Okay? How messed up is that? But that's real. Global leadership and rank and file must be aware of, and we have to constantly make other people aware of the difference between us and the nonprofits. Okay, between our internally democratic and accountable leadership model and the leadership model that the nonprofits put out. Nonprofit leaders are always either self-elected, self-perpetuating boards, or selected directly or indirectly by their funders and detached from the constituency that they supposedly serve. And through the locals, the internally democratic Green Party really has to contend for leadership of the social movement with the nonprofits. If we're not doing that, then they're going to eat our lunch. And we're going to be irrelevant. Or we'll continue to be marginally irrelevant. People rise up on their own accord when they're insulted and outraged enough. But when the outrage dies back, who comes in?
Nonprofits.
Yeah, they got staff. They're funded. You're not. Okay? So the churches and the nonprofits, often the same people, are the only players on the scene with any staying power. Active staff people from active locals and active Green parties can bring real support to initiate to existing movements, or they can initiate them. We can't do that now. We can't. I mean, the Green Party, I'm in Georgia. The prisoners go on strike. They call us and ask us, what the hell can we do? Well, you know what? We don't have enough people to return we don't even have enough money to accept all the collect phone calls from prison that we got after the prison strike, let alone to help these people. Come on. Green Party locals, also, to keep people sufficiently engaged enough to pay the dues, to take part, they're going to have to emulate the example of the church. People don't join a church because they agree with the doctrine. Half of them don't know the doctrine. That's why they go to Bible study, and they still don't understand. They join because it's got activities for kids. They got camps. They got tutoring. Okay, they got services for the elders. All right, they join because it's wraparound community. And if you're paying dues, if you got staff, you can try to be wraparound community. The OCP used to have summer camps and stuff like that. The old CP newspaper used to have, as Howard just said a few minutes ago, one of the best high school sports pages around, because people actually read the sports pages. And then after they read the sports pages, maybe they can turn to the front page of the Daily Worker and get some other kind of input, you know? Green Party locals have to have paid organizers who can make sure the party's responsible to member needs and teach them this stuff, how to conduct meetings, how to recruit, how to hold public forums, how to conduct political education, how to participate in or initiate issue-based campaigns, how to actively, not passively, leaflet. How many times have you took people out to leaflet and they're like, or table, and they're like sitting at the table waiting for somebody to come up to them and ask them, why are you sitting here? But folks have to be taught. People are teachable. And they're there because they want to do something. You got to teach. And you got to make it your mission to do this. Locals have to do that. Locals can teach people how to write election or issue-based campaign plans, how to raise money, petition, how to canvas, how to keep databases, how to communicate regularly, how to build relationships and solidarity with communities and frontline communities, as we call them in this campaign. The objections, some people say dues are illegal. You said legal. We got
it. Yeah. Just to sort of segue from the movement question, you know, one of the issues we face is, and the foundation funders behind these movements like this, single issue rights. Different issues, different constituents are competing for the money. And, you know, in my life, I've been involved in movements, and then some people kind of get, they want to be on staff, And then they changed the issue they're working on depending on what the fashion of the foundations are. So anti-nuclear power became anti-nuclear weapons, became Central America, became anti-apartheid. And the same people are moving around, leaving the old organization with the issue now resolved without funding and support. And the old movement dies. And you really want to understand how the nonprofit industrial complex works. There's a book by Robert Allen, came out 68 or 69, called Black Awakening in Capitalist America. Robert Allen was writing for the National Guardian, a radical paper back then. And he talks about how the Ford Foundation, very systematically, McGeorge funding, they said, we're not going to fund SNCC, we're going to fund CORE. And we're going to push a black capitalist ideology, and CORE's people said, okay, we're black capitalists, give us the money. And he traces this. And it's a blueprint for what you can see with every progressive movement since. Now, as Bruce said, before the 60s, it was farmers' alliances back in the 1800s, unions, and political parties on the left that would organize the fight of tenant farmers, or tenants getting, evicted in their in cities. You know, the CIO, the left parties, who are fighting each other, like cats and dogs, Marxists, Stalinists, Marxist socialists, but, you know, in different cities, those parties were actually very important to getting the unions organized. And what they could do as parties is relate the issues. So I think that's part of that discussion. Now, when we had the battle in the 90s, people were saying, oh, dues are illegal. If we're going to be a real political party, dues are a poll tax. The legality question. There's this case, March Formue, who was the Attorney General of California, versus San Francisco County Democratic Central Committee. And that was just the first committee. A bunch of Republican, Libertarian, and Democratic committees sued because the California attorney, sued saying the most contentious issue was whether the committees, when they designated a candidate, could support the candidate in a primary. This California law says the constituted committees can't take sides in a party primary. So they said it's our right as a party to back who we want. You know, if use the example, David Duke wants to run for Senate in Louisiana. Should the Republican Party have the right to say, we're going to run somebody against them in a primary and support that person? That's what the parties were talking about. There was also a provision in the state law that said central committees, it wasn't that dues were illegal, it's that if you're on a state central committee, you have to pay X amount of dues so the parties have some money. That was in the state election law. The party said, you can't tell us to pay dues or not to pay dues. We can set our own dues as we want. This was a Supreme Court decision that gave the parties these rights under the rights of free association and free speech in the First and 14th Amendments. That's the ultimate law on this question. And since then, the Supreme Court has backed up party rights cases. So if somebody tells you dues are illegal, the only thing really we can't do is say who can vote in the primaries. That the election law, there's a compelling state interest, the courts have backed that up. But if we want to say only dues-paying members can designate in our party committees of candidates, elect representatives to state and national conventions or committees, we can do that. It's been done. The Libertarian Party's done it for 20 years. The Socialist Party, now very small, but back in the, they did it under the primary system, which we have now in the, you know, early part of the 20th century, and they still do it. So the legal question is not an issue. The other thing that comes up is there are poll tax that will discourage the poor and working class from participating. And I've lived through this debate. And it's always the professors and the lawyers who say this, almost always. And they say, oh, the poor working people, the poor people, they can't pay. You have dues, poor people won't participate. The fact is, and we didn't put citations down, but you can Google this and find out how much people in different income classes give to charitable and civic organizations. Mm-hmm. And the lower on the income scale, the more they give.
Right. Because Thomas Award likes to talk about how homeless people donated. And right. There was a little discussion in those circles. Well, he's homeless, should we take his money? And the answer was, you know, if you don't take his money, you're denying him agency. Mm-hmm. He wants to give you this money to get this done. He wants to take part. Take his money and do what you're supposed to do.
Duh. And poor people's organizations that have been effective, like ACORN, like the National Welfare Rights Organization, they wanted $5 a month. That's $60 a year. And I hear middle class Green squealing about that amount. And the poor people are saying, because, you know, if you're working class, they might be in a union, they understand dues. NACP, you know, or the church, so.
This is the last slide.
Yeah.
We're through. At this point, we should take questions, comments. How do we roll that?
Well, yeah, let's
can you switch the light all the way up? And we're gonna be unrepresentative here and do the first three questions from women. Red.
Let's say we try to keep maximum 2 minutes and then
I would say maximum 1 minute. Because that way we'll give time for more people.
Okay.
Great. Okay, so we'll say Sherry, this lady, the lady here, and the lady in blue in back is four. We'll do four at a time. Come on, Sherry.
Sherry Hakala, Philadelphia. I just want to say that I think this was excellent. It was really exciting. I think all members should get a copy. I think it's incredibly important that we're talking about the nonprofit industrial complex. I think one of the things that I would add to this is when you say that you get money from foundations, I think we should spell it out more. Like, you know, Ford, okay, who's the chair? You know, it was Coca-Cola, IBM, Xerox, you know, we're talking about the very corporations that the Green Party says that we are, you know, fighting. The other thing is that I think that we need to consciously develop a new left political alignment that's independent of money. So we're talking about developing a due structure so that we're self-sustaining and we can support ourselves and do the necessary work that we have to. But I think that with the nonprofit industrial complex, people are not conscious of what that means. If you want to know more about that, you can go to my workshop.
thank you for this. It helps so much. And here in Minnesota, I was just talking to my friend who's a Green in Minnesota. She's
My
name's Amber Garland. I'm from Minnesota. And she's actually afraid of the Green Party becoming, of the Green Party Minnesota becoming a major party because she says, Amber, we're not ready for it. We can't handle phone calls. We can't handle the structure and organizing. We have some members who are so overworked, they are just burned out, deep-fried crispy critters. Mm-hmm. And so we don't have enough people to do all the work. So this, we need this.
Three, four, I guess it was, you and then the lady in blue. Name?
I'm Dawn Neptune Adams. I am from Wabanaki Territory, which is now called Maine. My question is, how would people feel about, instead of having it only money, if we could do like a time bank system where we could donate hours of our time, which, let's be real, it is money, and have that as part of our membership. Some of
we
us don't even
exactly
have
that in
five
Georgia.
Bucks.
Mm-hmm. We discussed exactly that in Georgia. Lady in blue?
Peggy Cotin, California.
I was actually pointing to the lady in blue in front of you, but you can go.
You go first and then I'll go.
You're all wearing blue over there.
I was actually pointing to you. Yes.
Okay. Peggy Cotin, California. I appreciate the information you're giving. I would like concrete ways that we can manage to receive the dues or go at half of the dues. So that's something I would like to get from others, if time allowed, afterwards.
Okay. You may.
I do have one issue with the dues-based and the conversation about how even poor people can afford this. Mm-hmm. Because as I look around this room, I doubt that there's any people in here who are actually really poor people. We talk about working poor, we talk about middle class, but there's an awful lot of people out there who are not working poor because they can't get jobs. And they're living in an area, in a neighborhood, where they're being constantly harassed. Their wallets are being pilfered by tickets. I'm dealing with a situation right now where a perfectly innocent man is being taken from Texas down to Kentucky on an old child support
thing.
He's up, the states aren't talking to each other. And because of this, he's on his way in one of those buses down to Kentucky. He's going to lose his job. He's living with me because he hasn't, so that he could get caught up. on all of these things. I have a real serious problem with us thinking that even, you know, maybe one homeless person was able to do that, and that's a great story, but I don't think that when it comes right down to it, there are a lot of people out there who cannot afford the $5 a month. And maybe we could do sort of a scholarship program, or maybe what somebody else was talking about being able to volunteer hours. But the idea that it's only cash and only those people get to vote, I think is a problem.
Like I said, when the prison strike came, we got dozens of collect calls from prison. We could not field those calls. We could not answer them. I mean, prisoners are calling and you can't answer the phone because you ain't got no money. Come on. We got to do this. Hands. This guy, Mr. Grimsley. Oh, actually, this lady, you were the one that I thought I was pointing to, the lady in blue. The one in front, and the lady in blue in front of you, and one in back of you. You next, and then the lady in green, Mr. Warren Grimsley, a guy. This old guy.
What's old guy you talking about here?
Gentleman on the end, and the one next to him.
Okay.
And I hope you remember that order.
You can call them by numbers.
People are stacked.
My name's Amanda. I'm here in Texas.
Louder. We can
go stand up and speak. Stand up and speak.
From Texas. Here, actually. And I had two questions. I was wondering if you had done some surveys or some research showing the numbers, how much would a membership bring in to the Green Party? I mean, you're talking to the choir here, we've all donated. But when you're asking for a lot of people to provide a membership dues, I mean, do you have any numbers showing how much of your budget would kind of
Here.
Membership dues? And then I was really glad that you talked about doing things local, because I've run membership campaigns, and one of the things that people really ask about is, what are you doing for me? Like, I want to see a result.
Like, yeah, I'm going to pay dues if you're not doing something for them.
Exactly. Right. So I really like that you put that in your...
Yeah, there's a wonderful book called Raising Expectations, Raising Hell by Jane McGallaby. Anybody ever heard of it? Raising Expectations, Raising Hell. The lady was SEIU. They sent her out to repair a broken union in Nevada, Las Vegas, a right-to-work state. She wound up organizing every hospital in town. Okay? And in a right-to-work state, you've got to come to the workers every 60 days and have them and ask them for dues money, or else it doesn't get paid. Okay? And they succeeded in doing that in a right-to-work. That's really all it means in a right-to-work state, is that you have to ask for dues money. Face to face. Okay, who are the other people that you called on? This lady, and then come on.
Hi, I'm Julie Carlson. I live in St. Louis. One of your slides showed that a lot of times that there's an uprising and people get disappointed and angry, and that's when a movement is ripe for welcoming new people. Well, I think this is the moment right now. We have a political election that there's a lot of anger in, and I think we have an opportunity here. We have a national election. We have two incredible candidates at the top of our ticket, and many, many people in this room even running for statewide and local office. How do we go back from this to St. Louis and Atlanta and Philadelphia and LA and Chicago with concrete ways to welcome people who want to vote a third party right now at this time, and then use all that, welcome these people, and then grow our party with an opportunity like this to pay dues and to give people ownership of being a member of this party?
Well, you just gave us your email address.
Yeah.
We'll have to be in touch. We'll have to figure something out. By the way, John Wu Baraka, our vice presidential candidate, is in the room. We're going to let him say a word. It's not like it's minute away, so you know who we are. Oh, God, I'm sorry, Warren. Yeah, let's do Warren first. I did say Warren next, and then you. My apologies.
Warren Brinkley from the great indebted state of Illinois. My question is, say, okay, I got buy-in. What permission do you need to start this? Do you have to go through some part of the Green Party? Or can you two guys say, this is it, we're
going? On the state level, you probably need to examine your bylaws and make sure that there's nothing in there that keeps you from doing this. And then maybe put something in there. And then, since there's nothing in there that keeps you from doing it, start doing it. And then, in order so that somebody can't stop you from doing it. Afterwards, repair your bylaws and lock it in there.
Well, it's the state.
Well, you have control over the states now. The national is another question. Oh, no. This guy, then this one, and then this one. Yeah, you're third.
I don't consider myself an old guy. A better for the wear.
Yeah.
There you go.
Not bad.
But, see, I think an organizational question is first a political question. We need new members with enthusiasm. Sanders got hundreds of thousands of new members. Why? Not by organizational means, but because he put a very simple message. Tax the rich, 1%. And those ideas didn't come from a party. They come from those young, occupied people who were very politically inexperienced, but they struck a chord, and Sanders suddenly had millions and millions of dollars and hundreds of thousands. So first of all, for us, is a political question that then gives you the resources to build an organization. And organizational issues also have great experience for us. And look at our party. I cannot see our party becoming a serious party unless it gets rid of this consensus. I'm trying to restrain myself here from calling nonsense, where we have one member in the state that I'm from who's given the party such a bad name that in my area alone, three young people have left.
Yeah.
And I said, this person should be put out of the party. They said, oh, we can't do that because that's a green party.
And it's not the green. What do you recommend instead of consensus?
Party. You gotta get rid of this
modified consensus that works. We had to do it.
Officially our time is up at 1:45, but nobody's banging down the door to evictus. So we're gonna go to noon if you got the patience. The next two are this gentleman and then this one. And then we'll get the guy in red and we'll see what's up from there. Go on.
I'm Brian, I'm from Houston also. Just listen to some of the things you're saying. I think that's the way to go. The membership dues, and you can collect the dues and then designate your different candidates for different offices. How does that correlate with ballot access? I mean, do you have to even have a primary? Do you say, this is our candidate for a county commissioner, or this is our candidate for judge, or what? How would that actually play itself out? And then two, why would you shun money from, say, the union or some of the other progressive organizations?
Well, the quick answer to that was how he wants to do it. Come on.
All right. Well, my position is people's PACs are okay with me. You know, if they're democratic organizations, a union, an environmental group, peace organization, those people pool their money and want to give to candidates, I think we can accept that. That's people's money, not corporate money. But you got to draw a distinction, you know, whether that PAC is, you know, I work for UPS. UPS say, he's an employee. Let's give him some money just to, you know, say we're good citizens.
Yeah.
I say thanks with no thanks. My union, Teamsters 317, I take some money. So that's what I would say on the PAC. All right.
Yeah. George Martin, Wisconsin. Wisconsin, we have membership dues, and we also have sliding scale, and you don't turn anybody away. And also, most often, people throw in a lot more than that $30 a month. Getting back to the local thing, and we always have this conversation when we get together every year in terms of social movements. And only if you have a local grassroots organization can you participate. So for example, in early 2000, Milwaukee Greens decided our number one issue was going to be privatization in public schools. We grew within the black community in leadership because we made that our fight. You know, so we're out there with our banner in terms of police accountability. We're out there and take leadership in climate efforts and always say we're green. As a former leader of this national peace movement here in the U.S., I always say I'm green. And when you say that, then the connections and the validity comes through. But that's on the grassroots level. Thank you. I highly encourage that we need to be organized at the local level in participating in our communities and not showing up at the black church on election time.
I'm Bernie August. I'm with the Green Party of Delaware. We were very involved with the Occupy down in downtown Wilmington for 9 months until they threw us off, of course. But From the Occupy, we have started the Women in Transitions. Most of us are activists, green activists. We have software in transition. You can get it for timeshare to exchange for other like I can lay cement. You need, and you have auditing skills. So you barter back and forth for your time. Somebody said about time sharing. You can get that software that exists, and you can design the software for people to want to contribute in different ways if they can't financially do it, but you try to do that. But the possibilities are tremendous when you have community activism, like George states, because all of us are involved in some sort of environmental problem in Delaware, or setting up community gardens, doing all sorts of things socially, promoting Black Lives Matter, we go to all the protests, we're there. So this is how it's done. But you can raise funds and money, and you can get membership to increase. As soon as you get that going, and you get your name out there, they will come. It's like the Field of Dreams. Build it, they will be there.
So. Yeah. Okay, we're going to do five more questions quick, and then we're going to ask Jamu Baraka. By the way, Sherry, who asked the first question, was the vice presidential candidate. Most of you know that. Well. Oh, okay. All right. Well, then we'll do Howie's going to hold forth, and then we'll take three more questions, and then we're going to let Jamu say a word, and we'll be up here answering questions, and we'll be in touch with you via email and stuff, too.
No, I'm an after question. I just wanted to respond.
Oh, after. Okay, go.
Oh, no, you have more questions.
Oh, let's say three more. What about that young guy there? This not as young fellow here. And,
skip the age business.
Well, I have to find some. I mean, I tried Lady in Blue. And
give them a number.
Ladies in Blue.
Give them a number. That's so, give them a number.
I have a number. All right, this gentleman and then this one. And then we'll see if we got...
All right, Elijah Manley of Florida. First, I want to say part of the reason why I left the Democratic Party was because they were greedy, and especially greedy when it came to dues, especially to young boomers and young members. So I don't think dues should be required.
Louder, speak up.
I don't think the dues should be required. But
can't hear!
I don't think the dues should be required, but I do think that we should ask for the dues, because if you don't ask, you don't get. So you, at first you have to ask for those dues, and that kind of ties into public financing of the campaigns or of the campaigns the party is doing. So if you have that money, instead of trying to go out and find ways to get that money from other sources, if people are contributing to your local party or something like that, you will have enough money to do campaigns like in Bart we're doing the takedown of racist slavery symbols in Hollywood. And by the money the party members put together in Broward County, we're able to, you know, buy fires and do stuff like that. So if you, your local party can contribute amongst itself. But it's all about building a volunteer base. So that's all I have to say.
Yeah. Howie, is this related to open shop versus closed shop?
I'll make a comment on that.
Okay, with you. One more, and that'll be Ms. Garrison, and then we're going to do Howard.
Okay, I just want to say I don't fully understand how this is going to work, but I'm going to go home and call my Alameda County Green Party and ask how I can start paying dues. Is that a start?
Yeah, well, I would ask how they can get everybody else to pay dues, and how they can define themselves as a party by where the party and the people who are the party members who vote on things are the dues-paying members. You're going to have to actually look at your party bylaws on the state and local level, okay? Because for all we know, some of them might prohibit that, in which case you have to change it. In Georgia, they don't prohibit it, so we're just going to do it. And then the next time the cycle allows us to change bylaws, we'll lock it in. So,
okay, I just wanted to respond to a few of the comments. I don't think open shop versus closed shop is relevant as a comparison, because it's not like we're a voluntary association as a party. It's not like when you go to work, you got to join the party like you got to join the union to be employed at a closed shop. So I don't think that analogy holds. I do remember a conversation between Murray Bookchin, who some of you may know, and James Barr, who was kind of a senior advisor to the League of Revolutionary Black Workers and SNCC and whatnot in Detroit with Grace Lee Boston. These two old guys at the First Green Gathering, they're like walking by each other and looking at each other. They both said at the same time, "Didn't I see you at the UAW convention in 1948? Yeah. Oh yeah, I remember you. And so the thing they talked about was how once they got the automatic dues check off, the bureaucracy detached from the members.
Yeah.
And while I think we should have people, you know, set it up so their monthly contribution automatically goes, the caution is, if we do get well-funded, we got to watch our bureaucrats so they don't become like our union bureaucrats.
Gotcha.
So that's one point. As far as the dues, and look, if somebody's in real hardship, there should be a waiver. The Socialist Party has a waiver. You know, if somebody really wants to be a member and they're in a situation where they don't have any cash, you give them a waiver. They just apply for it. We take it on the honor system. But the norm should be, you know, if you're going to be a party member, you got to put some money to help us do what we all want to do. In terms of administering, what we do in New York is we pay a state party due, and where your county is organized, that's our unit for locals, half of that money gets rebated to the organized county. If your county is not organized, the state organizer gets that and helps your county get organized. So that's how we're trying to promote the organization. The question of how do we implement this, I think you can start with your local and then go to your state party organization. And as we start to do this locally, I think we can set up good examples and then convince the national structure that this is the way we can go. And we have good examples to point to. You know, George points to Wisconsin, where actually in that state, the Republicans and Democrats have a tradition of paying dues. Now that's different than campaigns. We can fight for public campaign financing, but we got a lot of other expenses. Between a campaign, which has to set up legally a separate account, we got organizing to do. We got members to help. We got organizing the unorganized counties in our state or the unorganized states in our nation. So we need another fund. We can't just wait for public financing, which we won't get till we got more power or we're really threatening the system. I think if we wait for public financing to say we'll have enough money to run, we're just like never going to get there. Now, somebody asked about how we do the membership convention next to the primary system. Depends on your state's laws. We can designate our candidate, but we may have to fight for them in the primary. Like I use the example of David Duke and Republicans. I don't know what Louisiana laws say, but according to that decision we cited, their party committees can fight against David Duke if they want to. I don't know if they will. So I think those, and then the question of contributing time instead of money. No, we need money. Now, we should also expect time. I mean, Ralph Nader, in 96, when he just stood and didn't really raise any money, he was saying, you want a party? You get 1 million people to give 100 hours and $100 a year. You'll have a budget of 100 million. You'll have a mass of volunteers who are doing 100 hours of work for the party. And you got $100 million to hire some people to work day to day.
Right.
I mean, that is the scale. We get to that scale, then we can really compete for power.
Okay, at this point, we're going to be in touch. And obviously, this is not a discussion, it's over. And if Ajamu wants to talk to us for a couple of minutes, we want to be out of here at noon. So this is Ajamu Baraka. We're going to let him say this.
Wait
10 seconds so I can start.
I want to shift the dynamics. I mean, I really enjoy hearing this conversation. This is exactly where we need to be going.
Amen.
If we're talking about trying to compete and build real power, we've got to recognize we're up against a concentrated, serious enemy that has serious resources. You know, people are ready. They're ready to build a political alternative. We got to be ready for the people. And we don't need to be shy and tell people, look, we want you to participate, but you don't really have to put any skin in the game. Yes. Now, we tell people that for us to participate, for us to advance, everybody's got to be in all the way, including giving up some resources. And I'm going to tell you, and Bruce knows this too, those of us who've been organizing poor folks for a long time, people are prepared to give up what they need to give up. If they are, if they understand and are supportive of the mission. Right. Folks get money. Poor people get money. That's why the state would target poor people with fines and all kind of stuff.
That's right.
So people, when they have to come up with $150 to pay a ticket, they can come up with $10 a month if it's about their liberation, and they believe that to be the case. So we don't hesitate with that kind of conversation. We've got to have those kinds of conversations. We've got to have them now and be prepared to, in fact, do that, because right now is the time to really build this Green Party, okay? If we are not going to be dependent on any force, we've got to have that kind of independent political alignment that Sherry talked about. We've got to be independent of all pressure forces, all pressure groups that may be trying to come into the process, but they have some resources, and they believe they can have influence. We got to be independent even of campaign structures, okay? We've got to be prepared to stand up for our principles and not be worried about other resources. So, okay, I just want to say thank you.
Okay,
thank you. I'm gonna get the hook from Bruce. And we'll see you tomorrow. I wish I could be around some more. I have to run to a meeting.
Last word, 60 seconds from Howie. Thank you.
I did want to ask a question. Sister asked, how do we use this campaign to build toward the type of structure we're talking about? And I would recommend you take names. You learn how to canvass by phone, by doorstep. Who's going to vote for Stein and Baraka? And you keep those lists. Day after the election, you go back to those people. Say, we're organizing Green Party local, whatever you got. If you don't got a local, you organize one with that list. If you got a local, you bring them into the local. And, you know, and then the dues question, you got to bring that up with your existing people. And but I think that's how we use this campaign to build toward that structure. I mean, between now and we got about 100 days to that election, we need to be taking names, identifying support. I mean, you've got the excuse now to call people up cold, to go on their doorsteps. And that's one of the things about election campaigns. We're not talking to the usual suspects that show up at our stuff. We can talk to anybody. We got a good reason to. And we can find new support. So that would be my answer to the sister's question about how we use this campaign.
All right. Thank you very much.
Everybody, web pages and Facebook pages should have a PayPal account attached to it. There are people who can't donate their time or anything else, but they want to be active, they want to contribute, and they just want to give you some money. So make sure you get a little PayPal tab on all of your web pages. It's easy. You don't even have to have it connected to your bank account right now. It'll sit in PayPal. That's what you do. But that's something you can go back and do right now. And people will be like, oh, I can donate some money. Or you can have, like, again, attached to the PayPal, whatever your annual is, $5 a year, $10. That's what the Jill Stein campaign has on it right now, and every local can have that tab. So, just saying.
Who's this? Yeah.
My other glasses, I'm afraid I can't find my glasses.
Your stop right there. I don't want to do that either.